Last week we looked at the story of Esther and just talked about what happened. I want to come back today and make some application from this book. What do we learn from it? Let me begin by asking you a question, though. Did you notice who wasn't mentioned in the story? Not even one single time. God was never mentioned in the story of Esther and Mordecai. There is no mention of him whatsoever in this book. In fact, this is the only book of the Bible in which the word God or Lord does not occur a single time. Nowhere in the book is God specifically or explicitly referred to, either by name, title, or even attributes. You know, there's no mention of the Almighty or the Creator or anything like that in this book. Now, I would venture to say that probably last week as we told the story, most of us from our monotheistic viewpoint, that is believing that there is only one true God, that we easily saw God in the story. We saw him working behind the scenes. We saw his providence, we might call it. Let me ask you this question. What did you see in the events regarding Esther's rise to being queen of Persia? Vashti initially refusing Xerxes, what seems from our perspective, a trivial request, and as a result is deposed from the throne. What do you see in the fact that there is a four-year gap between when Vashti was banished and when finally a replacement for her was sought? What do you see in that about that time there just happened to be a young, beautiful, and available Jewish woman named Esther living in the city of Susa, the capital of Xerxes, as he's looking for a new queen? What do you see in Esther, who from among all of the beautiful and eligible maidens, she alone was the one who found favor in the eyes of all who saw her? And ultimately found favor in the eyes of King Xerxes and was placed as queen on the throne in place of Vashti. What do you see in those events? Coincidence or providence? What do you see in the events regarding Mordecai's uncovering of the plot to have Xerxes assassinated? Do you think it was just a coincidence that he was in the right place at the right time and overheard the plan? Do you think it was just a coincidence that that happened at such a time when he has just found this new access to the king's ear via the new queen, Esther? Do you think it's a coincidence that he wasn't immediately rewarded for his good deed? And yet, even though he wasn't rewarded, his deeds were nevertheless recorded in the chronicles of the kings of Persia and Media? Was that coincidence or was that providence? What about in Xerxes' interactions with Haman? Do you think it was a coincidence that King Xerxes couldn't sleep the night before Haman came to present his request to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had built for him? Do you think that it was a further coincidence that the king decided, you know, since I can't sleep, let's have the chronicles read to me? And do you think that it was a further coincidence that of all of the chronicles in the book, that the account that was read to him was the one about Mordecai uncovering the plot on his life? Do you think that it was a coincidence that when the king realized he had not yet rewarded Mordecai for this great service, that he immediately sought for one of his officials to come and rectify that situation, and the official who happened to be walking into the court of the king at that very moment was none other than Haman? Do you think it was a coincidence that when Haman and Xerxes were at the banquet with Queen Esther, and she reveals that she is a Jewish woman. That Haman throws himself on her couch to beg for his life, and yet King Xerxes sees something very different. He sees him trying to accost the queen. Do you think it's a coincidence that Haman is then executed and hanged on the very gallows that he had constructed for Mordecai? What do you see in those events? You probably see the providence of God in all of those. But as I objectively sit back and try to read the book of Esther, you have to agree that if one held an atheistic worldview, that is a view that there is no God, that things are just left up to fate or predetermined conditions, coincidence, well, that kind of a reader would attribute everything that they read in the book of Esther to coincidence or just dumb luck. And maybe even one who held a polytheistic view, that is, there are many gods, a pagan or idolatrous worldview, they might attribute the happenings of the book of Esther to some nebulous, well, it was the will of the gods that these things happened. Even if you evaluate the book of Esther from a purely literary standpoint, it's just good writing. That's the way a story is supposed to be told. It's a great work of fiction, a great novel. It has everything. It's got heartbreak, it's got new love, it's got political intrigue, it's got betrayal, it's got suspense, it's got revenge. It holds the interests of the reader or the hearer. It's captivating. It holds your attention. It's shocking. It's got humor. And in the end, it's satisfying, isn't it? Everyone gets their just desserts. It's a happy ending. You see, there are more than one way to look at the book of Esther. I think there's a couple lessons that we can learn from the way that we look at the book of Esther, at the story of Esther. Number one, and maybe it's a question that we should ask ourselves. Am I just taking God's presence for granted? He's not mentioned anywhere in the story. He's not referred to directly or indirectly. In fact, the closest that you get to a reference to God is really not even a reference to Him, but to His providence in Esther chapter 4 and in verse 13 and 14 when Mordecai is stressing to Esther, you need to go and ask the king to spare the Jews. He says to her, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. We read that and we say, obviously, God put her in that place. That's what Mordecai is stressing. Don't you think that God put you where you're at for just this exact purpose? But that's not what the text actually says. We're reading that into the story because we just assume that God is there. Even Haman's wife, later on in chapter 6 and in verse 13, Haman's recounting to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. And the wise men of Zeresh and his wife said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. And we say, there's God again, right? She recognized that the God of the Jews was more powerful than the God of the Babylonians and the Persians and the Medeans. And since Mordecai served the God, the one true God, he would be successful. But that's not, again, what the text actually says, is it? In fact, if any special privilege is given to anybody, it's not to God. It's to the Jews. And yet we just assume, we read our perspective into the text. We just take it for granted that God is behind the scenes, pulling strings and working everything out exactly as He would have it to be. And the question that I'd like for us to think about for a minute this morning is, do we do that in our lives today? Do we just assume that God will be there to make things work out well for me in the end? That no matter what, God is out there and He's working in my life and He's just going to make things turn out well for me in the end. Almost like I expect Him to do something for me. It's almost like, let me suggest to you, if we just take God for granted, it's almost like we're living our lives and conducting ourselves in such a way that we think God owes us something. But God will just take care of it. It's no big deal. God's got it covered. He's always got my back. Do you see what's wrong with that perspective? It's an us-centered perspective. God is my buddy. God is here to serve me. God is here to make sure that my life turns out well. God has my back. And what we've done with that approach is we've actually flipped the whole program on its head. God doesn't exist to serve me. I exist to serve Him. And yet, when I just take Him for granted, and just assume that He will make my life a certain way, I'm actually demonstrating some selfishness. And we need to be careful of that. And that leads into the second lesson or the second question, because I think it's just as dangerous. In my taking God for granted, am I failing to give God credit in my life for the things that He actually does do? You know, it bothers me as I read the book of Esther. There are so many places where I do believe that God is working. That God is behind the scenes, making sure that things are playing out just so that His plan and His purpose will be accomplished. And it irks me a little bit that the author of this book doesn't take advantage of those opportunities to draw attention to God. I mean, what was up with the author of the book of Esther? Why does he fail to acknowledge the presence of God? Well, there are a couple possibilities that have been suggested. One possibility is that this was written not by a Jew or from Jewish sources, but was written from Persian sources. There is reference to the chronicles of the kings of Persia and Media, right? And that's where these things are recorded. And so maybe it was just that somebody found this information in this secular history record and they just copied the information down. And because that originally was written by somebody who didn't believe in God, there is no reference to God. Okay, but if you believe in God and you're inspired, why wouldn't you include some of that in there? Another possibility that's more troubling to me is that the authors intentionally omitted references to God so as not to offend the Persians among whom they lived. That the Jews were somewhat embarrassed because of their social surroundings. They knew that their people would see God in there, but they didn't want to draw undue attention to that fact because they might catch some flack from their neighbors. And I wonder, do we do that in our lives today? Do we see God working in our lives? Do we feel His presence? Yes, maybe behind the scenes, providentially. And yeah, we gladly accept the blessings that he sends down upon us. We want those, right? Maybe even in our heart, we're thankful to him for what he's done, but we fail to acknowledge him. We fail to actually give him the credit for the kindness that he is showing towards us. Is it because you're embarrassed of him? You're embarrassed that if somebody were to compliment you about some good thing that happened in your life and you were to say, oh, let's give God the glory for that because he's the one who's behind it. You're embarrassed that maybe they'll look at you sideways. Stupid, ignorant, superstitious person that believes there's a God up there working in their life. What a nincompoop. If you've not paused at least once in your life when somebody has pointed out some great thing that's happened to you and you felt like, you know what, I want to give God the credit, but you go through this mental process, right? I wonder how this person's going to perceive that if I do it. I think we've all probably gone through that at least once in our life. For me, it happens more often than I'd like to admit. But for whatever reason, we fail to give God the credit. We fail to praise him for the things that he does. Maybe sometimes it's because we think, well, I just don't know if God really was behind that or not. Right? I mean, is God behind it when you pull into the parking lot and you're struggling to find a parking space and then the spot right up front opens up? See, everybody laughed and giggled, didn't you? Because we think that's a little bit childish and funny. Why? Why couldn't that be God providentially blessing us? Or maybe it's a test from God. Are you going to take that parking space selfishly for yourself, or will you continue to look for one farther away and let the next person in line have that one? But either way, couldn't it be God working in your life? And yet, why don't we acknowledge that? I think sometimes for me, it's because I'm afraid that others might think I'm being a little bit too hokey. But you know what? Why wouldn't it be better to accidentally give God credit for something that he didn't do than to fail to give him credit for the things that he does all the time? Let's not be embarrassed of our God. Let's not be ashamed of him. Let's give him glory, even in the little things in our lives. Let's see if we can't do what we can do to draw attention to him in the things that happen in our lives. That's the way, I think, that we're going to help other people to see God as a real, living being. The traditional way in which we view Esther and Mordecai is that they are somehow these paragons of faith and trust in God. We look at them as these great heroes of faith. And we look at them as though they are selflessly seeking to achieve God's purposes as they faithfully serve the Lord with their lives. And we use that interpretation to explain things like Mordecai's refusal to bow down to Haman. Because we know Jews, God-fearing Jews, they don't bow to anybody but God. And we make a parallel to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 3. They wouldn't bow down to that golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up because they weren't going to serve it like a god. They were only going to serve their God. We use it to explain Esther's willingness to surrender herself over to marry a foreign king as if somehow she knows that by doing that she's going to be in a position where she can then achieve God's purpose and plan. And yet I would suggest to you that the evidence within the story of Esther itself doesn't support that view. And let me preface this by saying that not all characters in the Bible are always perfect examples of godliness. And yet, even though they are flawed and they fail and they have shortcomings and do wrong and sin, that does not detract or diminish from their value or their purpose or the work that they do or did. You know, we looked a while ago at David. At a very low point in his life, he stepped into the place of God as the avenger. He was going to take his own vengeance against Nabal, wasn't he? And if it hadn't been for Abigail coming and interceding, David would have sinned on that instance. We could think about Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19. He was so discouraged and so depressed, he was convinced he was the only one left serving God. And he's running away and asking God, just let me die. Is that an example we need to follow? Absolutely not. Think about Jonah, who just flat out refused to do the will of God. He was supposed to go and prophesy in the city of Nineveh, and he said, no, I don't want to go. And he ran away. And it took a huge storm being swallowed by a big fish to get Jonah to realize, okay, I'll do what you want, God. But then if you read the book of Jonah, Jonah goes and proclaims against the city. And then when they repent, something good, Jonah goes, oh, well, I told you that was going to happen, God. That's exactly why I didn't want to come in the first place. But Jonah is not a good guy. He's got a lot of bad attitudes. Even think about Paul, the apostle. He had a bad day one time when a young fellow by the name of John Mark wanted to go with him on a second preaching trip after abandoning him on the first one. And he said, no, I ain't taking you. And Barnabas said, well, if you don't take him, Paul, then I will. Perhaps Mordecai and Esther aren't exactly the righteous and faithful Jews that we sometimes have credited them as being. There are some troubling facts that would suggest that perhaps Mordecai, in particular, far from being a humble, God-fearing Jew, was actually a prideful, self-promoting opportunist who is seeking a personal political advantage in this story. Not that being politically active or involved in a foreign regime was sinful or even unprecedented. Daniel was the number two guy to Nebuchadnezzar. But there's a stark contrast in the way that Daniel rose to his position of prominence and the way that Mordecai attains his. Daniel was promoted there because he said, I'm going to do whatever God tells me to do, and I'll let the chips fall where they may. And by putting his faith and trust in God, God elevated Daniel up. Mordecai doesn't seem to have that attitude of, I'll do whatever God says to do and let him take care of me. He seems to be politicking and maneuvering and manipulating in an effort to get himself into a position of power. Consider these troubling facts from the story of Esther and Mordecai. Have you ever wondered why Mordecai would be okay with his cousin, his daughter, his charge, Esther, going into the harem of a foreign king? Marrying a foreign idolater? And why would Esther go willingly? You go back to Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. God's people are explicitly instructed not to intermarry with foreign idolatrous people. And that was something that remained true through the time of the judges and the kings, though it was often violated. In fact, in 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 4, Solomon is pointed out that the thing that drew him away, his failure, was that he married many foreign wives and worshiped their gods. And what's interesting is that this prohibition against intermarrying with foreigners stays in effect until after the time of Esther in Ezra chapter 9 and 10 and Nehemiah chapter 10 and 13. Years after this event, the Jews who had gone back to Judah and intermarried with the people of the land are told to put away their foreign wives. God didn't want his people marrying idolaters. And Xerxes was an idolater. Why would Mordecai tell Esther that she needs to keep her identity as a Jew a secret? Weren't the Jews supposed to be proud of who they were? They were God's chosen people. Why would Mordecai tell her, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew? Perhaps it was because that would have disqualified her from being a candidate to become queen. In fact, from the time of Darius Hystapus, Xerxes' father, it had become kind of an unofficial rule among the kings of Persia that they were only allowed to take wives from other Persian families of nobility. What's in a name? Esther is not this gal's given name. Her Jewish name was Hadassah, which means myrtle. Esther is her Persian or Babylonian name, and it means star. It actually comes from the Persian word Ishtar, which was the name of the Persian goddess of love. The Canaanite parallel was the Ashtaroth, which the Israelites are constantly told, don't dabble in the worship of this pagan goddess. She's put oftentimes right up there with Baal. The Israelites got in trouble because what did they do? They went off and served the Baal and the Ashtaroth. And this chick is named after that goddess. Mordecai. I don't know if that was his given name. I doubt it, because Mordecai actually means worshiper of Marduk, which is the Babylonian equivalent of Zeus. Now, I don't want to make too much out of this, because certainly other Jews who went into Babylonian captivity had their names changed, right? Daniel, which means God is my judge, he had his name changed to Belteshazzar. But that means Lord of the Straitened Treasure. That is, Lord of the treasures of those who are poor. Even Hananiah, which means God has favored, was changed to Shadrach, which means the great scribe. Mishael, who is what God is, was changed to Meshach, guest of a king. And Azariah, which means Jehovah has helped, his name was changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nebo. And that alone is the only other one I can find a reference to that is associated with any other foreign god. Nebo was a idol. So I don't want to make too much of the name change, but it is interesting to me. And I would suggest even Mordecai's refusal to bow to Haman does not have to be attributed to the fact that I'm a Jew who only bows to God. In fact, you go back and you read 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. All the time, people are bowing down before their king, their rulers, as a sign of respect for them. And that seems to be what Xerxes said, I want you to do to Haman, because he's my vizier, he's my number two guy. Everybody respect him, honor him. And Mordecai said, no. That's interesting when we're introduced to Haman in Esther chapter 3. He's described as the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. There's a Jewish tradition that says that Haman was a descendant of the Amalekite king Agag. Remember, he was the guy that Samuel had to hack into pieces because Saul failed to wipe out all the Amalekites. The Amalekites were one of the oldest enemies of the Jews. They were the first people who attacked Israel when they came out of Egyptian slavery, before they even went into the Promised Land. And God had promised that from that day forward, there was always going to be animosity, war, strife between the Amalekites and the Israelites. And the Jewish Targum suggests that Mordecai's thoughts towards Haman were not so much, well, I'm not going to bow to him because I only bow to God, as much as they were, no self-respecting Benjamite would bow the knee before a descendant of the ancient Amalekite enemy of the Jews. He was too prideful to bow and respect Haman. And ironically, that's what instigated all of the problems in the book of Esther that needed to be solved. If Haman hadn't been, or if Mordecai hadn't been such a hothead and would have just been respectful of Haman, Haman wouldn't have hated him. If Haman didn't hate him, Haman wouldn't have decided to kill all the Jews. If Haman hadn't decided to kill all the Jews, God wouldn't have had to providentially intervene to save the Jews to fulfill his promises. You see the irony there? One of the things that troubles me the most about the story is Esther's request in chapter 9. The king's already granted the Jews one full day to execute judgment against their enemies. You got a whole day to slaughter as many of your enemies as you want. And after that day's over, Esther comes into the king and he says, "Hun, is there anything else I can do for you?" And she says, "Well, you know, I'd really like for you to give the Jews in Susa one more day to kill some more of these people. And I'd like you to command that the bodies of Haman's 10 sons, who we've already killed, that their bodies will be hung up on the gallows as a public display." Does that sound like a God-fearing, righteous individual to you? That sounds a little bit to me like David in his temper and his anger, wanting to annihilate the household of Nabal. And then even when you evaluate the book as a whole, it's so interesting to me. What is the point of the book? Why was it written? From a literary standpoint, everything is building to chapter 9. With the establishment of the Jewish holiday, Purim. Everything that's related to us in this story, in this account, is explaining why this Jewish holiday exists and where it came from. From the banishment of Vashti in chapter 1 to the selection of Esther and Mordecai uncovering the plot in chapter 2 to the introduction of Haman and the subsequent conflict and hatred between him and Mordecai, the plot against the Jews, the intervention of Esther, the turning of the tables in chapters 3 through 9, all of that is just a setup to explain the existence of the Feast of Purim, which takes up verses 20 through 32 of chapter 9. And notice, as you're looking through chapter 9, who the emphasis is placed upon for these things. Verse 1. "Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day, when the king had commanded and the edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them." In verse 5. "Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them." Verse 16. "Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's province assembled, defended their lives and rid themselves of their enemies, killing 75,000 of those who hated them." Verse 18. "But the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and the 14th of the same month, and they rested on the 15th day, and they made it a day of feasting and rejoicing." Verse 19. "Therefore the Jews of the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food." Who's making these things? They're making these things. In verse 20 through 23, "Then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate, commanding them to celebrate the 14th day of the month and the 15th day of the same month annually, because on those days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies. And it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions." The Jews are doing these things for themselves. You know, when God gave the law, he gave them specific holidays, specific feasts, specific days of fasting, specific days when they were supposed to go and worship and sacrifice. God gave them what they wanted. One of the things that happens throughout the time of the captivity is that the Jews start instituting a bunch of days for themselves. And the Feast of Purim is one of those days. In fact, it's interesting if you go back to verse 2 of chapter 9. "The Jews assembled in their cities throughout the province of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand before them." Why? Because their God was so powerful? because they feared their God? No, for the dread of them had fallen on all the peoples. Even all the princes of the province, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews because why? Because they feared their God? No, because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Even Xerxes is given credit in verses 24 through 25 for the turning of the tables against Haman. Not God, Xerxes is credited for punishing Haman. If my hypothesis is correct, and Esther and Mordecai are not these great godly people, that doesn't have to destroy the lesson we learn from this book. If anything, it reinforces the fact that God can use anyone, even those who aren't working with him, to benefit his purposes. And let me suggest to you, the same can happen today. Let me give you a few modern day examples. The first thing is that God can often use bad examples to help us see what we ought to do. The abusive, derelict father. The absentee, selfish mother. That oftentimes inspires their kids to say, I don't want to be like them. When you see people acting like jerks at school or at work, you say, I don't want to be like that. That's God trying to get your attention, to get you to straighten up and act differently. Sometimes it takes seeing our ugliness on somebody else to get us to realize, I've got to make a change. That's God working in that event. God can use even hypocrites to achieve his purpose. You know, Jesus said, the Pharisees sat themselves in the seat of Moses, therefore listen to what they say, don't do what they do. I'll tell you this, personally for me in my life, the reason why I'm standing in front of you today, the reason why I ever started preaching or had the courage to get up and deliver my first lesson as like a 17-year-old kid. In fact, the reason why I even lead singing is because there was a man who just didn't give me an option. He said, you're going to do it. And I appreciated this man. I respected him. And all the time where he was pushing me and encouraging me to develop my skills in song leading, develop my skills in preaching, and training me somehow to even do those things, he was living a double life. And I wouldn't follow that man anywhere now. But I know this, I'm not who I am today if it wasn't for some of those influences in the past, even the influences of hypocrites. How many of us have not been touched by tragedy or heartbreak as a result of somebody else's sin? And yet that was the thing that prompted or motivated or got me moving in the right direction. God can take the sinfulness of somebody else and their wrongdoing, and he can use that to be the impetus, the thing that gets our attention. Just the same as he can use oppressive and ungodly rulers who try to make it difficult to do what's right. You know, these kinds of trials, these kinds of tests, these are like refining fires. It helps to weed out who really is God's and who is just a casual Christian. God can use the wickedness of others to build our faith. But you know, God can also use your own personal stubbornness and pride to get your attention as well. Sometimes we find ourselves in a position because of our own stupidity, our own arrogance, our own selfishness, where we ruin our lives. Do you think that that's God's will for you? That he wants you to have a ruined life? Do you think he wanted the prodigal son to go off and waste his inheritance? He didn't want that. But that's what it took to hit rock bottom, to finally come to your senses and say, I'm going to serve God. The point that I'm trying to make is this, is that even though God's plans will be accomplished, sometimes even in spite of us, we will only benefit if we submit ourselves to God's plan. So this morning, as we think about some of these lessons we can learn from the book of Esther, Let's see God working in our lives. Let's give him credit and acknowledge his presence for what he's done and what he's doing in me. Let's realize that it may not only be good things, or what I think of as good things, as his working, but even things that right now I feel like this is a trial, this is a hardship, this is a difficulty, this is a struggle, that God could still be working in that to refine me, to bring me to be who I want, or rather who he wants me to be. And so having acknowledged God and seeing him working in our lives, let us busy ourselves working with him to achieve his purposes for us in our lives.